Good morning. My name is Hillary Draper, and I am a grateful recovering alcoholic. As one of my favorite AA speakers says, now that tells you who I am and what I am. And when the two of us got up this morning, the who said to the what, we ain't going to take a drink today. And that's the way it's been all day long up till now. But it didn't used to be that way. It used to be that the two of us got up and the who would say to the what, we ain't going to take a drink today. And the what would say, who said so? And the who would say, I said so. And the what would say, just you wait and see. And the what would get drunk and the who would have the hangover. On top of that, I used to stand up and say, my name is Father Hillary, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. But I've had marvelous sponsors. The two greatest sponsors I ever had, I never asked to be my sponsors. They just decided I needed them. Tom Pettis of Happy Memory and Raven Whitson. And I'm grateful. I didn't like them one bit. And every time they came, I was vanishing. But they'd track me down. And one of them, I won't tell you which one, said to me, after I'd been dry several years, said, there you are, going around Sam, say your name is Father Hillary, like you something. Said, you better stand up and say your name is Hillary Draper and you ain't nothing but a drunk. I thought that over. And I came to the conclusion they were absolutely correct. And my name is Hillary Draper, and I am a drunk. And it's only because of a higher power, whom I choose to call God, and to whom AA reintroduced me, and trying to practice the principles of this blessed program in all of my affairs a day at a time, and with the help of many people, especially the slow learners, where's Tony? Raise your hand, Tony. Back there, another slow learner. That Hillary Draper, the alcoholic, has been able to take on the role of Father Hillary, the priest and the monk, and for that I will be eternally grateful. Just absolutely eternally grateful. I don't want to forget my manners. I want to thank the committee, whoever invited me out here. I'm so delighted to be here. My gracious, isn't Eureka Springs something amazing? I want to come back. There's a lot of things I haven't seen done yet. I'm grateful to the beautiful fruit basket in case I got any hunger fits in the middle of the night. And one of those fancy, I think it's a toothbrush holder mug with a... it's coffee? I was going to use it for my toothbrush. And every time I wash my teeth, I'll think of you all and pray for you. So if I want to use it for a toothbrush mug, I can use it for a toothbrush mug. One other thing I have to say thanks for, and I'm going to ask him to stand up. Satan people don't trust me very far. And when some of the local yokels in Alabama found out I was coming, they said, we'll take you. And I wish that Don and Sharon and Carl and Dolores stand up and you see the kind of AA love we have in Alabama. And consequently reduced your costs. All right. So much for the manners. Now, it's 10:33 by this $4.21 watch that I got in Kmart. And I will guarantee that by 11:30, I'll be long gone. And then what she does with the rest of the time is up to her. But I will be long gone by 11:30, guaranteed. So, you know, you can face yourself according to that. We're supposed to say what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And my story has changed. I didn't used to think it would. But this is a program of growth, they told me. This is a program of recovery. They told me you're supposed to put the cork in the bottle, get in AA, and get better, not worse. It's a program of recovery. And I have come to know that it is, for me at least, truly a program of recovery. If you want to know my sobriety date, and I'm very proud of it, a day at a time, it's January the 14th, the Feast of St. Hilary, in 1968. I was celebrating, you see. And one day at a time, I haven't had to take a drink or to take a mood-changing drug since then. And for that, I'm everlastingly grateful. What I'm like, I can tell it to you real quick. When I joined the monastery as a young monk, I hadn't been in too many years, when another older monk walked up to me one day and he says, "You know, Father Henry, if you ever choose a motto, your motto should read, Videre quam esse." Well, I knew the classical motto read, Esse quam videre. And you translated that to be rather than to seem to be. And here this joker was saying, your motto should read, to seem to be rather than to be. And looking back on that, I believe there's a great deal of truth in that. I was always trying to be something I wasn't. Like somebody else who spoke, and haven't we had marvelous speakers today? Lord, Lord, at this meeting. I'd worry if it was an elocution contest. But my sponsor told me that an AA meeting is not an elocution contest. You don't have to beat nobody. Just stand up and tell your story and sit down. Don't worry about whatever anybody else did. Although I must confess, I was looking for that Texan, Jim, whatever his last initial is, run out on us this morning. I was waiting for him. First of all, I found out you can't trust him. It wasn't an Episcopalian who got drunk at the first meeting you all had. It was a bona fide Roman. And I will hereby apologize to all the lovely, as we call them in Alabama, Episcopalians for that slander. Dear Lord. But like so many of us, I was born at a very early age in a good Christian home. I've heard so many alcoholics say that, I'm not convinced any way as to raise children anymore. But I was. It was a Catholic home, Mobile, Alabama. I cannot tell you when I had my first drink. It was always there. Now, make no mistake about it. While we Catholics do not think it is morally, seriously wrong to drink in moderation, we do think it is a serious violation of morality to get drunk, just like the Baptists and some of the Methodists do. But if you had to know the philosophy of drinking that I grew up with, it was this. You drink as often as you want to, as long as you want to, as much as you want to, but you do not get drunk. And there are many people in my tribe who are still operating under that philosophy and are not alcoholics. If it could be said of anybody that he had an education as to how to drink like a gentleman, it should have been me. I told you that I was that philosophy that they said my motto should read. My father was dead when I was 4 years old. I know today that I resented God for that. I had a marvelous grandfather who was the male image in my life, a magnificent mother, but wasn't the same. It was not the same. The other kids had fathers, daddies. I didn't have one. And consequently, I learned how to be a people pleaser early on. First of all, if you want to know how to be born with a gold spoon in your mouth, you should be born the younger son of a widowed southern mother. The poor child, his father's dead. Man, I learned how to milk that. If you want to know how to get along in the world, you do what they say, and then you do what you please. Yeah, I got along with that for a long time. So I think, you know, my personality, if there's such a thing as an alcoholic personality, I don't know, but that's the kind of thing I was. They put it in a nutshell. I always grew up wanting to be something I wasn't. I was not a good athlete. I was a good student. Just a mess, really, when I look back on it. And I think my mother realized I was a mess. And by the time I was 15 years old, without asking me, she did not consult me at all. She informed me one day that she had sold me up the river to the tender mercies of the Benedictine monks at Cullman, Alabama. And she said to me, if I didn't love you, I wouldn't send you up there. But your father's dead, and you need more men in your education. And they nearly killed me. Oh, mercy. It was dreadful. But at any rate, there were little comforts. I came to know all the families of my classmates in Cullman, and all the housewives of Cullman in those years, worthy of the name, knew how to squeeze the grape and make that German-type grape juice. Only they did it with Cullman County strawberries. And if you all never tasted Cullman County strawberry wine before you got an AA, it's just too late. The most gorgeous color of red I ever saw in my life. Don't talk to me about Arkansas wine. The most magnificent bouquet, you could smell it in the next block when they took the cork out of it. A kick like the proverbial Missouri mule. You just have to wait till heaven, till you get there. It's too late. And there was no harm in it. You were in somebody's home, a glass of homemade wine, a piece of cake, glorious. I loved Cullman. I loved everything about the school. I asked him in 41 if I could become a monk. They said I could try. And after they let me in, I discovered a deep, dark secret. That the monks were not about to be outdone by the housewives of Cullman. And they also knew how to make that German-type grape juice out of strawberries. And they also made a little homebrew on the side. Now, looking back on this, you see, the big book says, we drink, alcoholics, because we like the effects of drinking. And I can remember from my earliest days that I liked the effects of drinking. It was convivial, it was party time, weddings, funerals. See, we celebrated funerals because we thought people went to heaven. So it was a celebration. Yeah, we cried, but that called for another drink. You know? I'm serious. That's the way we looked at it. It was a joyous occasion, a funeral. Yeah, everybody was crying, but that was expected. And, you know, but they'd gone to heaven. Thank God. And I wish we got there with them and save us a place. So it was there every time we celebrated, whatever kind of celebration, company, just anything. But I liked what it did for me. It made me feel so much better. It did. As a kid, I can remember that. I don't know whether I'm supposed to remember it or not, but I do. That's all there is to that. And when I discovered the monks, now they didn't drink every day. Nor was it even scheduled on a regular basis. But for big feast days, Sunday vespers, an hour after prayers, Gemütlichkeit, if you know the German word, you come together for conversation, smoke a cigar, sandwiches, homemade wine, homebrew, pink lemonade for the panty waist. You know. But looking back again, I was always the first one there and the last one to leave. And that's the truth. It meant more to me. I was always figuring out when the next time was going to happen. And to show you that I am an alcoholic, I experienced my first blackout when I was 19 years old. In a monastery, Christmas party. You don't join monasteries to become drunks. You join them as a special kind of Christian witness. And there I am experiencing a blackout at 19 years old. You know what that is. I'm not even going to explain. If you don't know, ask your neighbor. He'll tell you. But I'll tell you one thing about it. It's almost a Satan sign that you got it. If you're worrying about whether or not you're a little bit pregnant or not, and you've experienced a blackout, you might as well go join, change your letter from Al-Anon, move it over to the other side of the house. But there I was at 19 years old, already experiencing blackouts. Already the drinking is uncontrolled. I've told you that. I drink as much as I... From the time I was 19 years old until I got into AA, there were only two things that ever made me quit drinking. Now, that's true. One was I was too sick to drink anymore. Or number two, there was nothing left to drink. It was that simple with me. It was not easy for me to get drinks. And if you think I'm going to tell you how I did it, you are mistaken. I am not. I firmly believe that if you put an alcoholic on a Pacific atoll and left him there in short order, he'd have a supply of booze. And I don't know where he'd get it, but he'd get it somehow or another. Well, at any rate, there's my first sign. Again, I have to explain to myself what caused that blackout, that phenomenon. Was I losing my mind? I think I knew way back in the back of my mind it was alcohol. But you see, I loved everything about alcohol at that time. I loved the taste, I loved the smell, I loved everything about it. And for you to tell me that something I love that much could do something bad, I wasn't ready to accept that. But being an intelligent kid, I had to come to a conclusion. What caused that phenomenon, that blackout? And I came to the astounding conclusion that it was the cheese. Now, you laugh, but I haven't told you that to laugh. That's the truth. You see the stupidity? You talk about alcohol being cunning, baffling, and powerful. The alcoholic is cunning, baffling, and powerful. I told you, I think I knew way back, but I wasn't about to admit it. One of the characteristics of alcoholics is that everybody knows he's got a problem, except him. His wife knows it. His kids know it. His boss knows it. The neighbors know it. His dog knows it. And I'm serious. That's not made up either. You ever see a dog in the presence of a real live alcoholic? Cats haven't got enough sense to get out of the way. But no self-respecting dog will stay in the same room with a drunk. And that's true. But the poor alcoholic is the last one to admit that he's got a problem. I told you what I was like. And that refusal to face reality, that flight from reality, kept on and on and on. Alcoholism is a progressive disease. We learned that through the big book. It affects the totality of the human personality. It destroys us as individuals. It destroys us spiritually, mentally and emotionally, and finally physically. We come apart at the seams. And the horrible thing about the disease is that it affects at least four other people drastically. It destroys the lives of at least four other people. I mean, we heard it. You heard some of those stories that the Al-Anons told. That one over there, you know. She said her husband never got thrown out of the bar. How many times did she get thrown out of a bar? You know, that's insane behavior. I'm just quoting. She said it. I didn't say it, you know. But this disease is a real killer, and we don't see it. Something has to happen. Something has to happen. What has to happen is we have to come to a point when we would rather be sober than drunk. And contrary to what I have been saying for years, namely, I can quit anytime I want to. And people were saying, well, why in the hell don't you want to? You sure ought to. When the time came that I knew and I wanted desperately to quit, I discovered to my horror that I could not. All right, I'll tell you a couple of things people like to hear. I got a geographical cure removal after I was ordained a priest. I had been working in the school there. I didn't think they could run it without me, but got personality clashes going with the boss. And, you know, if you don't support the boss, he'll fire you. Or if he won't fire you, he'll make sure that you go out to Siberia or wherever. One day I got a letter. We were living in the same house just down the hall. Kevin knows what I'm talking about, but we weren't talking. And that letter says, you go to Barberville, Kentucky, and take Father Timothy's place. I said, where in God's name is Barberville? And one wag of a monk says, you go to hell, turn right, and walk 3 miles. They were wrong. It was only two. And I went to Barberville. Oh, Lord have mercy. This reminds me something of it, this area right here. It's in the Cumberland Gap area, where Tennessee and Virginia and what else come together in there? Kentucky. Oh, it was a disaster. I'll never forget the first month I was there. It was hot September. And I finished laying mass with Father Timothy, and he says, you go over next door to Aunt Sally Coon's for your meals. Aunt Sally Coon belongs to the Lottie Moon Circle. But her husband, Uncle Albert, is a lovely retired Catholic miner, and he takes care of the church while you ride the circuits. And whenever you're in town, you eat over in their house. And they get the rent free. So we go over to Aunt Sally Coon's. Four-room miner's cabin. We're in the kitchen. A deal table. Uncle Albert's a lovely man in his 60s sitting there. There I am. There's Father Timothy. Uncle Albert's son is a 37-year-old state trooper. All the animals have passed shots. His two sons, 17, 18. Conversation was difficult. Had a water glass sitting in front of me, beaded, just like this one. And I picked that thing up, and I took two great big swallows. Well, you've seen the atomic bomb blast. I'm not making this up. I couldn't breathe. I couldn't see. I couldn't hear. The hair on my neck stood straight up, you know. Now, again, I'm convinced that if I had not been an alcoholic, I would have screamed bloody murder. But I don't. I just hang on tight till the tremors pass. I'm not making that up. And when I can see again, I notice Uncle Alvin's got one, Timothy's got one, the trooper's got one, the kids haven't. Well, when that breakfast was over, Timothy and I were stepping high over the weeds going back to the church. And I can remember just as clear on a Sunday, it wasn't Sunday, I said, Timothy, what in the Lord's holy name was in that water glass? He said, moonshine, 120 proof. I said, for breakfast? He says, anytime you can get it. What a glorious place to send a budding alcoholic. And I bloomed. I want to say Timothy's gone to heaven, but Timothy also made this blessed program for a good 10 years before he passed away. And we were great friends and went to many AA affairs. But at that time, we were both two-fisted drinkers. Man, I can remember. The alcoholic goes through stages. You can read it. You can read it. It won't tell you in the big book. Yeah, some of it does, but all these studies they do. Well, we have a tremendous capacity. The priest over the next mountain used to come, an older priest, and he'd say, we'd be going to some church function or something. I'd say, you want a drink? He'd say, yes. Well, in Kentucky, you never pour another man's drink. You hand him the glass and the bottle. He pours his own. And you always pour yours first to encourage him. So I can still remember this. He's gone now. But I got my water glass, and I picked out, and we were talking away, and I took that bottle, opened it up, and I poured it, and it came up, and his eyes got bigger, and finally he says, aren't you going to put any water in it? And, bold, brassy, nasty, I said, that's enough. That priest never offered me another drink? He didn't. Not till the day he died, he never offered me another drink. And you used to go over and see him, he'd always offer you a drink. He never offered me another drink. He never said anything about my drinking pattern. But he never offered me another drink. And so I progressed. I said, I don't get into trouble in Kentucky, but I didn't do the job I could have been doing if I hadn't been drinking. Serious drinking takes time. You know that. And that's why you've got AA, to do something with that time that you no longer have serious drinking. I'm returned to the college. This time I'm dean of the college, but this time I'm hooked. I got to have it. I don't have to drink it, but I got to have it where I can look at it, shake it, and look at the frog eyes, read the labels. What do you got to have it for, a cabinet full? Well, in case of snake bite or Hungarian Freedom Fighters Day, I don't know, but I got to have it. And the pattern is the same. Once I start, I don't quit, because there's nothing left, or I'm get another geographical cure removal. Hurry this one up. This time to the Delta of the Mississippi. And if you all think that is in southwest Louisiana, you are mistaken. It begins in the lobby of the Peabody Hotel in Memphis, Tennessee. And it goes down the river, 40 miles on the Mississippi side, 20 miles on the Arkansas side, you come to Yazoo City. And if you all think you have lived in the South and you have lived in the Delta, you don't know the South. Those people don't know the Civil War was fought. They don't even know it was lost and couldn't care less, period. The long, hot summers of the 60s. I always had so much trouble with the empty bottles. Every time I opened the closet, full of empty bottles. I said, who's putting those in there? I cannot have drunk that much. That's another sign that I was an alcoholic. Normal drinkers do not save empty whiskey bottles. They throw them away. But I had to save them. For what? I don't know for what. But there I was in Mississippi. I could pick up the telephone and say, Mamie. She said, be right there, Father. Now, when I tell you that story, Father Malachy says, be sure they understand that Mamie was the bootlegger. Isn't it disgusting? Merp, whatever they call her, says, I don't know what they got you up there Sunday morning for the spiritual program. You know what I got to say? I've never been yet to an AMA meeting that wasn't a spiritual program. So. But there I was. Mamie would come, take the dead soldiers out, give them decent Christian burial, put in new recruits, and send you a bill at the end of the month. Got it made in the shade. Made in the shade. Except just like the big book says, I was coming apart at the seams. People were going to talk ugly about me. I knew something was wrong. I was supposed to be a preacher, a priest, filling the pulpit honestly. And I knew every time I drank, I was getting drunk. And I never intended to. And, you know, people were talking, other clergymen, and things were getting voice, and the blackouts were coming, and where's the automobile? Where did you put the car? It's a brand new $8,000. It's not yours. It belongs to the church. Where is the automobile? We want the car. I don't know where the car is. Did you leave it in Memphis? Oh, it's funny now. It wasn't funny then. Oh, Lord. And then if you knew where it was, what condition was it in? God help us. Well, that wasn't the end. That new boss back at Coleman, he didn't know what was going on. And I got nominated as president of the college at Coleman. I was offered the job. You want to know the insanity of alcoholism? Now, listen to what I've been telling you, that track record. Priests and everybody's talking. And when I'm offered that job, any sane person would have said, I cannot take that job. What does the towering ego of the alcoholic say? Of course I'll take that job. You don't think they'd be offering that to a drunk, do you? And that'll show these people whether or not I got a problem with drinking. And they gave me a glorious send-off. I know today they were saying, thank God he's gone. But again, because of this program, I've been able to make amends and I can go back to Mississippi and hold up my hand. I'm grateful for that. That wasn't the end. Things were getting bad. I came home and I was president of the college for 3 years. And I got news for you. Everything that hadn't already happened to me happened in those 3 years. It's the same thing. My sponsor says, if you stand up and say, well, I can't be an alcoholic because I haven't lost my family, I haven't lost my job, I haven't been in jail, I haven't had any DWIs. He says, if you're an alcoholic, if you cross that invisible line between controlled and uncontrolled drinking, stand up and say, yet. Stand up and say, yet. I've heard AA people stand up and say they were in jail in every state in the union. I've only been in one. I don't want to go anymore. Ooh, Lord. President of the college, dressed up in this black suit, didn't have this gold chain, his ring. And I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning. That's when I generally woke up. And I thought, this is a funny bed you're laying on. There's no mattress. When I got my eyes open, there were bars at the window. I thought, oh, Lord, you played hell this time. And when I crept to the window to look out, I still resent the people who built that jail. It was constructed in such a way that I could not tell whether I was in Mobile, Montgomery, Birmingham, Nashville, New York, or Rome, Italy. I had no idea of how I got there. No idea. God bless us. You talk about just horror and fear and loneliness and my God, what's going to happen now? You know, I have no idea of what's happened. Well, let me tell you, if this is a little bitty town, I'll bet you that there's some notorious Catholic in this town that if there was a problem with the Catholic Church that involved the police or the sheriff, they would call up that notorious Catholic and they would say something like this. Mr. Jones, we got a Catholic priest down in the drunk tank here. Rather than make a whole bunch of publicity about it, we thought maybe you'd want to come down here and get him. Well, at 6 o'clock in the morning, they came and got me and took me down to the sergeant's desk. And I tell you, there stood a man there that I just as soon seen the Pope. Guess who they had called? They had called the chairman of the board of trustees of the college of which I was president. They didn't know he was the chairman. That's one of those coincidences. I mean it. I'd just as seen the Pope John Paul as to seen that man that morning. God bless him, save us. And he was concerned. And he wanted to do something about it. But I conned him. He says, don't you think we ought to talk to the abbot, the boss man, about this? This is serious. And I said, no, it was the cheese. Those are enablers. I'm convinced there are two groups of alcoholics who get enabled and protected almost to death. One is the clergyman. Nobody wants to admit that the priests or the preachers are drunk. In our church, they say he's a lovely man, but Father has the failing. If he's got the failing, he's not a lovely man, I'll tell you that. And this old business about if he'd just be sober, he'd be fine, that's another lie. That's another lie. I've heard people say there's nothing worse than a drunken black man. And then I've heard people say there's nothing worse than a drunken woman. I know something worse. A drunken preacher. Nobody wants him. Nobody wants him. The church doesn't want him. And the church is supposed to be sweet, you know. The church sure doesn't want him. That's a cinch. Nobody wants him. The other group of people that I think get protected almost to death are women. No successful husband wants to admit that his wife is an alcoholic. She's got nerves. It's her mother. It's his mother. She's got too many children. She doesn't have enough children. Hell, it's drinking. But nobody wants to admit it. Well, the end came for me in December 67 when the president of the college was to make a statement, a State of the Nation speech, 8 o'clock at night. I made it. But the only thing is, it was 4:30 in the afternoon, and I was taking one more drink to steady my nerves, and I went into a blackout. And to this day, I don't remember anything from 4:30 that afternoon until 6 o'clock the next morning. And I made that speech. And when I tell you that, I begin to sweat. Because I can have some idea of what it must have been like for that wonderful group of people. The faculty, the monks, the Student Government Association, the lay faculty, the Senate, the trustees, the board of governors, what it must have been like for them to sit there and watch and hear the obviously drunken Catholic priest president trying to make that report. That did it. I still don't remember. Maybe I don't want to, but I cannot remember. I do not remember, and that's the honest truth. But that did it. I had figuratively slit my throat from ear to ear. The next morning, I noticed on campus the atmosphere was a little cool. There was a specially called meeting of the Board of Trustees. There was only one thing on the agenda, namely the president's resignation, ipso facto, PDQ, as fast as you can. And several days later, I was in the boss's office, and he sat me down, and he read me the Riot Act in 3 or 4 gorgeous technical scenes. He told me that I was a drunk, that I was a disgrace to my own good name, that my family wouldn't do anything like that in Mobile if they knew what was happening, that I was a disgrace to the Catholic Church and to the priesthood, that I had done my best to tear up that college, and that those monks were so sick and tired of me, they wanted nothing more to do with me. And I was through, and I could get out of that place. Now, I don't know whether you understand what I'm telling you, but when that man talked to me, the two things that I love the most in life, namely my priesthood and St. Bernard, were gone. As far as I knew, there was no way that they could ever come back again. You couldn't put Humpty Dumpty back together again. He said, I'll help you get a job anywhere in the country. You're a good teacher. But what I wish you'd do is go somewhere, get some help with your drinking problem. He doesn't even know the word alcoholism. And I said, yes. I would go. I would go anyways and do anything. And I don't know what let me catch that moment of grace. For I'm convinced, as another speaker said, if I hadn't caught it, I would be dead or insane right now. That's all there is to it. I couldn't have stood the burden of guilt, and I couldn't have stayed sober. No way, no way. I'm convinced today that if I caught the moment of grace, it was because of all the Al-Anon type people who loved me so desperately and who knew nothing to do for me except to pray. And I said, yes. The old man had heard of a place called Hazelden up in Minnesota that had a reputation for doing something good for people who were bad to drink. And I got sent to Hazelden. And I arrived in Hazelden on January the 14th. Now, there are no such thing as AA treatment centers. There are what I call gold-plated south traps that will dry you out, introduce you to the pills, and turn you loose to run again. There are treatment centers that use this blessed program of Alcoholics Anonymous to try to teach us how to live a day at a time, soberly and justly, in this world. And that was Hazelden at that time. I'll never forget, I'm telling the truth. I didn't know what they did to you, to treat you for alcoholism. I know where they cut something out of you, where they stuffed something up in you. I know where they blew through your ears, where they turned your head around. I didn't know. The first morning I was there, all dressed up in my black suit and my collar. And I went to see the counselor. That's not true. They took me to see him. I was dry. I hadn't drunk anything that day. At that time, it was a 21-day program, 3 weeks. Yeah. And the first thing he says to me is, "Now, Father Hillary, that's the last time we'll call you Father, because you ain't nothing but a goddamn crook." They talk so ugly. Profane. I started to write the absent. You know where you've sent me? He said, "You have no right to wear that Roman collar. You are not in good standing in the priesthood. Take it off." Do you see the towering ego? There I am, in a treatment center of alcoholism, butter wouldn't belt in your mouth. God knows, you know. And then he says, "Don't plan for 3 weeks for this program." I said, "Of course not. I reckon I'll get it in 2. Oh, he says, "No." He says, "We find for doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, undertakers, pharmacists, college professors, priests and preachers, it takes 3 and 4 times as long to get this simple program." And I said, "Why?" They said, "Because you all keep up such a dreadful front. It takes a long time to get behind there and find where the real Hillary lives." And that was true. It took a long time for me. They gave me the big book. That's not true. They sold it to me. And they said, "Read it." And I opened it up to see if it had a cross in it and the approval of a Roman Catholic bishop. And it didn't. And I said to myself, it's probably foot washing Baptist literature published in Nashville. Isn't that awful? I'm not making that up. I would not read the big book. They were not going to brainwash me. Now, let me show you how sensible that was. Because at the same time they sold me this, they sold me the little 24-hour-a-day book. You know that? Well, it doesn't have any cross and a bishop's signature in it. I loved it. I read it just wow. I wouldn't touch that thing. Do. The only thing they did is they had 3 meetings a day, morning, afternoon, and night, in which somebody explained one of those steps. And it took them 3 weeks to go through all the steps. And they had some private meetings when they tried in groups to get you to face yourself. Well, after about 4 weeks, it became apparent to my cunning alcoholic brain that the people who were getting out of Hazelden were working steps 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And it became further apparent to me that if I didn't take, work, or do steps 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I was going to be in Hazelden until Gabriel blew his horn. Reality was beginning to sink in. And I decided, now this is the truth, I decided I didn't want to be there that long. And one night, I sat up and I read the 164 pages. I wouldn't read 165, 164 pages that constituted this program. And I read it all night long. I couldn't wait for breakfast to get over. I shot down to the counselor's office. He hadn't even time to go to the bathroom. I said, "Let me in." He says, "What's the matter with you?" I said, "I've got step 1. My life is unmanageable. I'm powerless over alcohol." He says, "You ain't got nothing. Get back." I said, "I got step 1. I'm an alcoholic. I'm powerless over alcohol." He says, "You ain't got nothing. You are loaded with resentments." I says, "I don't resent anybody." The blindness of the program. I resented God. I resented the Pope. I resented the bishop. I resented the abbot. I resented all the monks of St. Bernard. I resented everybody. And I couldn't see it. I couldn't see it. Lord have mercy. I have to tell you quickly where the breakthrough came for me. And maybe, coincidence again, There were 121 people up there at that time, and the only thing we had in common was alcoholism. There were all kinds of people, all kinds of people. And there were other religious people. Well, they were the slowest of all. But there was one little creature about 4.5 feet tall, and he didn't have much to say. But one day he came in to my room on a Sunday afternoon, I'll never forget it, and he said, "Can I come in?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, the counselors told me to come see you." He said, "This is my second time around. I was here in treatment for 7 weeks, and I went home and got drunk the next day. And the day after that, they sent me back to treatment." He said, "And my ego is so down, and I'm just so low, they say I could go through a closed door walking underneath it. And the counselors say if they can't get me up, the program will never work for me. But they say the counselors have also agreed if they can't get you down, it'll never work for you." Well, they hadn't told me that. But this little creature looked so woebegone. I said, "Well, did they tell you how to do it?" He says, "No." I said, "I'm supposed to get you up, and you're supposed to get me down so we can stay sober." Yeah. Well, I wanted to say, "That's the dumbest thing I ever heard of." I said, "Well," but he looked so pitiful. I said, "Well, sit down. What's your name?" He says, "My name is Brother Joel." I can tell that because he's gone to heaven, too. I said, "Well, you know, my name's Father Hillary." He said, "Yes." I said, "What kind of brother are you?" He says, "I'm a Christian brother. They run schools all over the country." He said, "What are you?" I said, "I'm a Benedictine monk." I said, "Where you come from?" Well, he says, "I come from Winona, Minnesota." He said, "Where are you from?" I said, "I'm from down near Birmingham, Coleman, Alabama." I said, "What y'all got up there?" He said, "We got a college." He said, "What y'all got down there?" I said, "We got a college." I said, "What you do in the college?" He said, "I was a president." He said, "What you do down there?" I said, "I was a president." And that creature had 2 PhDs, one of them in Greek, and he had a student body 4 times as big as mine. We talk about identification in this program. Well, both of us were losers. But we identified with one another. All of a sudden, there was somebody else. And we began to get better together. And I'm proud to say we both got better. We both got better. I'm proud to say that he went back to Winona, not as president of the college, but as head of the brothers, reelected year after year after year. And years later, he was celebrating his 50th jubilee as a brother. And he invited me to come up and preach for the occasion. And I wrote and I told him if I had to walk, I'd be there. And you haven't seen me dressed up. But you've seen pictures of Catholic bishops. I got the tall hats and the gold walking stain and the long trains and the lace and the red ribbons and the gold and the diamonds. I'm a very important Catholic. And when I went up to Winona to fill that pulpit, I had everything I could possibly put on. And they're all the brothers. They all knew who we were, Brother Joel and I. And they're all sitting at a church packed full of people. And the local bishops, you know. At the dinner afterwards, one of the bishops is saying, "How does Brother Joel know the abbot of Alabama so well as to have him come all this distance to preach?" And I looked at Joel, and Joel looked at me, and we said, "Bishop, neither one of us is going to tell you." Isn't that marvelous? Oh, dear God. Well, I think I had been up there about 9 weeks, and they said I could go home. And home, they said, "Go home." They said, "We don't want him." You see, we've had priests in Alabama and in the monastery who've had trouble drinking before. I'm the first one to ever caught this blessed program. But if somehow or another we could dry them up, we never let them return to the scene of the crime. We always sent them to Louisiana, Idaho, North Dakota, Montana, California, Hawaii. Go west, young man, go west. You never return to the scene of the crime. And here this blessed AA program is saying to me, "You go back to Coleman. You go back to Coleman." Not as president, but to pick up the pieces. Well, they wouldn't let me come back right away for certain reason, which is okay with me. I actually ended up in a halfway house. I left Coleman, as I said, January the 14th. I got back on September the 1st. And I wish I could tell you that I found AA September the 1st and walked up the steps and it was glory hallelujah. It wasn't. Couldn't find you. You were so anonymous in Coleman. Now, you did advertise in the newspaper every week, but I didn't see the ads. And so from September until January, I stayed a loner. And I was getting screwier and screwier and screwier, and that's true. I did read the big book. I did read the 24-hour-a-day book. I wouldn't go to the meetings. A priest that I knew very well said, aren't you supposed to go to mass? I said, yes, but they don't have them in Coleman. He said, sure, they have them in Decatur. That's only 30 miles. You go, I said, I don't need them. Finally, one day in early January, that priest came and had a piece of paper, had a telephone number on it. He says, for your information, AA is alive and well in Coleman. Call this number. Now, he's not an alcoholic. He can find you. I couldn't find you. Every day he'd say to me, did you call? I said, yeah, they don't answer. You will learn dealing with alcoholics that you have to ask the right questions. Finally, he says, when do you call? I said, midnight. Again, I'm not proud of that, but that's the way it was. He says, pick up the phone and ring them now. I did, and I got my sponsor. I got Juby. Huh. I'll never forget that phone call. I said, Mr. G, this is Father Hillary out at the college. I'm an alcoholic, and I need to go to a meeting. Just like that. And there was this long silence on the phone. And I found out what realists, AA people, are. The first thing Juby ever said to me, first thing over the telephone was, Father, are you drunk now? Which, of course, was the essential question. I said, no, of course not. But he says, it just so happens we have a meeting tonight at 8 o'clock. Notice the way he's read the big book. He doesn't tell me to go to the meeting. He doesn't tell me where it is. He says, we have a meeting tonight at 8 o'clock. I'll be along at 7:30 to pick you up. And I said, fine, Mr. Chief, don't come to the front of the college. I'll meet you down on the road to the cemetery in the dark of the moon under the pine trees. Again, I'm not proud of that, but that is the way it was. And if you come to Coleman, I will show you the road to the cemetery, the tall pine trees, the dark of the moon, where Juby came to get this priest. I wish I could tell you I walked up the steps and it was glory, hallelujah, never had any more trouble. It wasn't. I went up those steps and it was horrible. It was horrible. A little bitty room, not as big as that piece over there. The plaster was coming down, the wallpaper was rolling down, one old naked light bulb hanging down, a hole in the floor where they swept the dirt down, old sofa with the springs coming out, about 11 people, and they all looked like Church of Christ, the foot washing Baptist to me. And I thought, oh God, what am I doing in here? Now, that's the way it was. It isn't that way anymore. All you got to be is an alcoholic. I'm an exception. But that's the way it was with my towering ego. And Juby's disappeared, you know, like a good sponsor. And there I am looking through the window, the door, figuring, how can I get away from here? It's 2 miles back to the college. You know I'm not going to walk. And while I'm staying there, all this is running through my mind. Here comes a woman. God bless her. She was dressed better than this one. Just the most dressed up lady I've... And I knew her. I knew her as a fine Catholic matron from Decatur. I had worked with her on church affairs. I did not know she was an alcoholic. And she came out of that door, all dressed up. She says, hello, Father Henry. We're so glad to see you. You're right where you ought to be. Come on in. You'll be all right. We're so glad to have you. And she put her arms through mine, and she mesmerized me right through the door into AA. And the truth of that matter is I did not find out for 2 years. When they thought I was strong enough, they let me know that Rosemary was a shill. You know what a shill is? The dancing girls outside to get you to come in. They had called up Rosemary, and Juby had said, Rosemary, come to the meeting and call me tonight. She says, I can't. I got my own meeting. He says, I don't care what you got. Come down here and help me. I got a Catholic priest coming in here tonight. I don't know a thing about priests, much less Catholics. You're a Catholic. You get down here and help me with him. Talk about how to play the newcomer. And when the poor, stupid, drunken monk, Catholic priest is trying to walk through the door of AA, there's Rosemary holding out the hand of this fellowship. You know, I can get scared to death of what would have happened with me, my towering ego, if Rosemary hadn't been there that night. I don't think I'd have stayed for Juvie. I don't think I'd have had enough sense to know that I could love Foot Washing Baptists and Church of Christ people, and that they would have something to give me. I don't know. But Rosemary's still in the program. And man, I'll walk a long way for Rosemary. I wish I could tell you that I got into the program and it was glory. How it wasn't. I made every mistake you could possibly make in AA. For example, witness. After I had been in the program 2 years and a closed meeting, I said on one occasion, what I want to know is why am I an alcoholic? Me, with my splendid aristocratic background, I was a love child of God of my understanding, was given to me by tender, loving people, smart as a whip, degreed, an eminent theologian, least of the second water. What in the hell am I doing an alcoholic? And the great silence came over the group. When everybody knows the answer and they ain't going to see who's going to zap the fool. And Juvie, a car salesman, Juvie says, oh, hell, Father Hillary. It don't make no difference how the jackass got into the ditch. Just get him out. I'll tell you one more if you really want to know a good one, if you promise not to tell anybody else. One night at the closed meeting, I said to them, I want to know something else. I've been in this program now 3 years. Sober. I don't think I was sober. I think it was dry. But I said, what I want to know is if I don't manage my own life, who's going to manage it? They already know the answer. And again, this great silence. That's the truth, this great silence. And it was Juvie again. And he says, well, Father Hillary, step 3 says, made a decision to turn our wills and our lives over to the care of God. Step 11 says, thought through prayer and meditation. I said, keep quiet. Don't tell anybody I asked that question. Here I am, a trained theologian, and I've got to go to the drunks to learn theology. Gee. Well, it's been that way. It's been that way. Oh, Lord. I'm still learning. Oh, great day in the morning. I've got great sponsors, and they're still waking. Oh, they're still after me. Tell me to quit playing God. I want to tell you one story to close on. So many great and good things have happened in my life. Since I came into AA, and this is true, some of the people who know me know this is true, everything good that has happened to me since I came into sobriety has had some connection with Alcoholics Anonymous. Some connection with Alcoholics Anonymous. I think I'll tell you the one that I don't like to tell the most. But my sponsor says I should tell it because it's part of my story. In 1972, the abbot of the monastery resigned, and the monks locked themselves up and prayed to the Holy Spirit and proceeded to vote for a new abbot, a new head honcho. The rookies are not allowed to vote, only the full-fledged monks. It's a secret process. They go into a chapter room, lock the doors, and pray, and then start voting. But of course, everybody's interested. That was August the 20th, 1972. And when the election is completed, they ring all the tower bells and everybody comes running to say, who's the abbot? Who's elected? Who's the boss? And they still have to stay in to do all kinds of signing of papers and praying. But they always send out the word, who is the new abbot? And they sent out the word in that day that the new abbot of St. Bernard was Father Hillary. And the young monks are running all through the halls of the monastery, shouting, all the way with AA. That's what this gold chain and this big diamond ring are all about, see? And that's true. When I walk in the Catholic Church, the earth shakes. But it's AA that keeps my towering ego from getting me drunk again. I know, for example, that one more drink, and this gold chain and this diamond ring and all the accoutrements of the abbot's office are gone. We know enough about it today to realize it's a disease. They won't throw me out anymore. But I cannot stay sober just because I want to stay Abbott. I'll have to stay sober like everybody else because I want to be sober. I'd rather be sober than drunk. And you all have taught me how I can do that. And the point my sponsor says that I'm supposed to make in closing is that you put the cork in the bottle and you start practicing the principles of this program in all your affairs one day at a time, and there isn't any limit to where you can go. Thank you so much.